Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Live. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Live. We have a very, very extraordinary, exciting program for you today, and I would advise you to tune in and listen. We have as our discussion Brother Dr. Razi Hassan, also known as Brother Dr. Robert Blockham, of Birmingham, Alabama, one of the last battle stations of the Freedom Movement, Part 1, and a graduate of Knoxville College, Princeton University, and NYU. I've had the pleasure and the distinct honor of knowing him for, well, over 40-some years. And it's just a pleasure and an honor to have him on. We're going to discuss a lot of issues, including the Freedom Movement. And the Freedom Movement has to include the HBCUs, the historical black colleges and universities. Instead of shuttering black colleges and universities, I think we should be expanding them. We need 100,000 physicians. The historical black colleges should be expanding. Dr. Hassan is a professor of chemistry at one of the historic African-American colleges, Alabama State University, Alabama A&M University, I believe they're in Huntsville, Alabama. Welcome, Dr. Hassan, Brother Robert, to Religion Means Alive.
Okay, thank you, Brother Imam Alfred. Thank you for those kind words of introduction.
I would like for you to give us an opening statement as to where you see just the state, first of all, the African Americans, and secondly, as a part adjunct of that, the African American Muslims. It seems that we have gotten lost in the sauce. We were talking about building colleges, universities, hospitals. And now it seems that a lot of us are just caught up in rituals, Arabic, and we used to be talking about helping out people. Now we're talking about helping all people. Just help me to understand this upside-down equation, how people 40 years ago were talking about buying farmland and doing it, talking about building the universal system and working towards it, talking about producing physicians and working towards it. Now I have suddenly gone into
spiritual
stupor.
Yes, sir. And that's a very, very pertinent question for today. These 160 schools that were set up after slavery, and they call them HBCUs now, and I reject that description historically about black colleges and universities. I tell people that if the University of Alabama is a PWI, which is predominantly white institution, and certainly Alabama A&M would be a PBI, predominantly black institution. One of the major problems is that our initial mandate was to set up these institutions where they would help to bring our people from those hundreds of years of slavery into freedom vis-a-vis education and, you know, philanthropists and certain state institutions and the government were primarily responsible for the funding of these institutions. Now we're down to about 106. But we veered off even during our original mission because we were supposed to have gone after the the disenfranchised ex-slaves, and these institutions set up very close to the Emancipation Proclamation, which was, as you know, was 1863. For example, Alabama A&M was founded in 1875. And so, but instead of going after our people, we tried to mimic what the white institutions were doing. To some degree, that was justified because they served as a model. But we went even further, even in terms of if you look into the museums of these institutions and you look at the color of the students, especially the leadership, the presidents and so forth, these were basically the mainly the mulattoes of our class. And, you know, look at Frederick Douglass. He wasn't a part of the black university system, but look at W.E.B. Du Bois and look at Booker T. Washington. They were basically our mulatto brothers, and we began to recruit people to be presidents that were from the color class. In other words, we veered off from the original mission into trying to look like the Caucasian establishment institutions, even with the fraternities, which were another attempt to remove our people, you know, from the population, the main population of our people. And we set up the Greek letter institutions within our institutions. And so, but I don't mean to get too far off of this subject, but if you look in every town where these schools are located, including Alabama A&M, the schools that are on academic alert and caution, in other words, having problems, are located in the black communities. And the black colleges have essentially ignored them, the schools, the public schools that are having these problems, as being not their responsibility. And if you look at the, I call this emancipation too, if you look at the problems that we're having with education, with dropouts, with teenage mothers, and you know, and also the alcohol and the drugs and all of these problems. This is what these institutions should be. This should be our stock and trade, that we can solve these problems. But you know, like I said, you know, jokingly I used the term bougie. If we just have gone into the onto the bougie aspect of it, and we look upon those problems as being those other people. They are not us. But if we don't identify with this, then there's no reason why these colleges should stay open. I mean, you know, I mean, it used to be a time that, you know, somebody in Chicago said, let me send my baby down here to Alabama A&M so they can get a good education, get a good knowledge of themselves, and so forth and so on. So that's not really happening. So, you know, it's a, I mean, then the expenses that are involved are such that they say, well, look, let me keep my baby here in Detroit or in Birmingham and let them get an education here. See, now, when you and I finished school, Imam Muhammad, these options were not available. But now they are available, and people are voting with their feet as far as the African-American institutions. But my basic point is this, is that we have a mandate, a new mandate, which we must embrace. We started embracing the mandate at first in these schools, but we veered way off. And so we don't look upon the social problems that are affecting our community, therefore the overall society, as being our own. And until we do that, then, you know, somebody's going to say, well, look, hey, these $40 or $50 million that we're spending a year could be better served, you know, if we, I mean, the super rich in the States, if I could get another airplane for that money, or I could do this with that money, because the kids can go to the white institutions now. That's the danger that we face, and it's, and until we own up to the mandate of the mission of these schools, of the first mission, and this is the second mission now, because we have all of these problems returning. I mean, students who are returning from incarceration. In fact, there are more black men that are incarcerated now than there are in college. Until we own up and say, well, look, we have the solution to these problems. And if we step out there on our faith and belief, then God will bless us with the type of ideas and strategies that we need to solve these problems. And we got to stop burying our heads in the sand and trying to admit or trying to say that these problems are not ours and own up to them. This gives us stock in trade. And we can, and like I said, every school in America where they are having the academic problems are located in the black neighborhoods. And so, and even in the schools in the neighborhoods where the black institutions exist, we should start there and then offer the solution countrywide. So that's just my take on what is happening with the black colleges. Are you there?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. I'm here. I was listening intently, and what I'm wondering about, the African-American Muslim seemed to me to have lost his mandate. It just seemed to me that we're more concerned about Palestine, Kazakhstan, Pakistan,
yeah,
and every other place, and we're not considering, what's going on in Black Bottom, what's going on in our neighborhoods, and even in our own families of origins.
If you look at what the Muslims are doing, it's very similar to what blacks did in coming all off the plantation, those who were a little bit more educated than the rest of us. The Muslims are doing the same type of thing. We tend to go toward, one of the things, Brother Man, I'm not meaning to change the subject so abruptly, but the whole definition of minority and diversity, I tell people that slavery was not a diversity program. It was not minorities that came over here to build America. It was our ancestors. And we used to have that on the table big time, that we demanded reparations from this society. And you even have certain middle-class blacks who are saying that we should forget about that. You know, we got welfare, and we should be done with it. No, we should never take that off the table.
I'm not prepared to take that off the table. I'm going to tell you why. Because I'm thankful to Almighty God that my grandmother, not my great-great-grandma, my grandmother was a slave, and I would never take that off the table. And I am from a family of 13 brothers and sisters, about 12 besides myself, and I could see the damage from the plantation that was visited upon family members and even visited upon my own psyche and still trying to repair it. We're old, but I think we have first come to some kind of concept. As I'm really zeroing in on the Muslim, which I cannot understand how a person has come out of the Nation of Islam, who took a pledge Wednesday, Friday, Sunday, that he believed that this message was good for the black man and that he would work for the betterment. And now we seem to abandon it. What's up with that picture, brother?
Yeah, you and I were nurtured from the same womb, so to speak, or the same with the same breath, to use another expression, so to speak. We came into the Nation around the same time, and we embraced Honorable Elijah Muhammad's idea of pulling our people up, you know, from the muck and the mire, and you know, and to make our people better. You know, you remember how when we were boys, we were more than boys, I guess. We were very young men back in the early 70s, because you and I used to go out together.
Except to be a boy, I had lots of energy.
Yeah.
Didn't have my short pants on, didn't have my bow down.
We just wouldn't allow certain people to call us boys. But basically, looking back now, 50 years almost, we were boys. But we were sincere in what we were about, and we wanted to make our people better. But some kind of way, you know, we kind of got lost, and we started saying that we had to be perfect with the Arabic, and we had to, and you know, such that not meaning to digress, brother, ma'am, but you know, the Arabs who came.
This is an open exchange, and we'll open the lines up.
Okay.
But I think this is an important discussion, and I just say this: I think that this is such a precious discussion that we should open up discourse and dialogue. And I urge our audience to listen. I urge you who are listening now to call up your friends or text your friends and tell them. I think this is one of the most important discussions that have been held in the last 7 years in the, since Imam W.D. Muhammad. Yes.
The Arabs basically, they come over here. You see, in 1965, there were two bills that were introduced and passed. You know, one was the Civil Rights Bill, and, you know, we were obviously responsible for that. There was another bill that was passed that we were responsible for. This was the Immigration Rights Bill. Before 1965, most of the immigrants that came here were from Western Europe. And so we were saying that the white man should bring in more people of color. You know, we had erroneously characterized what was going on as saying that we said that we were 10% of the population in America, but worldwide, the white man is only 10%. And so we just assumed that if we bring more people of color over here, that we would be in the majority and then we could have more rights and so forth and so on. What we didn't see was the following. Now, even though Massa was cruel and mean and everything else, he was no fool. He wasn't going to bring people over here that were going to join with us against him. And we naively thought that by bringing people over here, but see what happened is that he recruited and still does the 10%, the cream of the crop, from the populations of these places, including the Arab places. This is the 10% who left and abandoned Africa too. They abandoned the poor in their own countries to come here to America to fight us for food stamps. And so there's a big lawsuit out there now. AP, I think, is one of the press agencies ran it about a month ago, and I wrote an article on it. It said, I think it was 65 organizations were suing Harvard because they were accepting people that were less qualified than them. These were Koreans and Arabs and other immigrant groups. And so you know who they're talking about. They're really talking about, you know, the African-Americans that these institutions, including Alabama A&M, are accepting. And these people, the bourgeoisie from these countries that come over here, whose children, they and their children, have had the opportunities of the best education in their countries, and even when they get over here, and they're saying that these institutions are accepting the students who are less qualified than they are, and this is discrimination. And so, I mean, I wrote a very article that hit at the core of what they are doing. And you see, basically what they're saying is that they want to take the place of this African-American who is, what they said, less qualified than they are. And so that's why, you know, in Washington I've said this, other meetings I've said this, is that slavery was not a diversity program. Slavery was not full of minorities. And this minority thing, what basically is a trick that the leadership uses to say, well, look, we got one pie here. We're going to divide it by all the people of color. Well, heck, everybody's a person of color, including the Caucasian, because no one is pure white. But what I'm saying is that they put us all in the same bag and say, okay, now we have to fight it out over this, these crumbs that he's going to throw to the quote-unquote minorities. We have to fight that. We must fight that. And, you know, we're not minorities. Slavery was not a minority program. It wasn't 10% Chinese, 10% Indian, and so forth. It was our ancestors and the ancestors of the descendants of American slavery. Not even the bourgeois Africans that come over here today, they're coming from a class of Africans who do not represent the poor in their own countries. And as I stated earlier, they stepped on top of the heads of the poor in their own country to come here to America. And they, you know, Africa needs doctors. Africa needs PhDs. Africa needs all those skills that these people come here and bring to America. And the same thing in India and China and so forth. And so this is the new emancipation. Is that we have to, and the Muslims, now you ask, what is the role of the Muslim? The Muslim, I think our role was really defined back under what we used to call the first experience. Is that we're supposed to take this ex-slave and bring him up to freedom, And this is why you and I join the with an organization called the Nation of Islam back in the late 60s. And so that mandate is still there. It's that we have the intellect and we have many other strategies to undo a lot of the problems that have occurred. So the Muslim has a tremendous mandate. We should not be out trying to impress the bourgeoisie coming out of these Arab countries, that we are so knowledgeable of Arabic and so forth and so on, that they should accept us. We should not give a cuss about that. We should not care about that. The only thing we should care about is bringing up the poor in this country and all over the rest of the world, because these guys that come here, they have abandoned that. They don't care about the poor. And this is what every religion says. Jesus said it. Prophet Muhammad said it. And this is our mandate, is that we have to serve the cause of the poor.
Yes, I think that this is a very important theme. And I think you brought up something that a lot of us fail to understand. And that is, while they gave us a civil rights bill, they knew that we were a people that were very vulnerable to influences. If you brought in immigrants, it's going to weaken our resolve. And the second thing, I'll never forget, I was imam in Baltimore. And an Arab man, very decent man, said, "Brother Imam, are you aware of the plot of the American government and the Arab government is against you?" I said, "No, I'm not aware of the plot." He said, "But you should be." He said, "Right now," this is 1978, "they are working against you all." And what we saw after that was a flood, a plethora of so-called religious authorities coming from overseas. And suddenly, where the steak and ticks were, we saw restaurants growing. We saw businesses popping up in Arab names. We also saw masajids. We used to have, maybe there was only one immigrant masjid in the whole city of New York. And all of a sudden, every neighborhood now has one. And this is this is shaking us as a people. And our authority as religious leaders have gone down because we already were weakened. And as a result of the fact we had been shattered from the plantation, and then the freedom that Imam Muhammad gave us, not for destruction and bad leadership, has really put us in a very mangled and very maligned and dangerous position. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, the dangerous position that I see is our own naivete. We assume that Arabic is equivalent to Islam. But Islam, I remember one student was talking to me about his father a few years ago. He was saying that his father had accepted Islam under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but he did not know the true Islam. And so I said to him, I said, "Brother, when he said there's no God but Allah, he had accepted the true Islam. Was he perfect? No. I mean, no one is perfect except Allah." And so he didn't have the pure religion, and he'll never have the pure religion. It's none of us will ever have the pure religion. And so, we accepted this mission to improve the plight of the poor, our poor, the poor people among the African Americans, and the poor among other people should be a part of our mission. But we, being African Americans, they said charity starts at home, and so we're better suited for that. And we should provide, as I said earlier, models for other people to see. And I think the strategies that we started using back in the first experience, our sincerity, our desire, to make institutions that were going to be suitable for improving us, that these models would be good for people all over the world. We thought as younger men that we knew that white supremacists should be killed. We knew that. And we thought that God was going to do it by killing all white people, more or less. But, the fact of the matter is this, is that even if God did see fit to do that, it wouldn't be the end of white supremacy, because it has spread so much that, you know, it's entrenched even among the 30 million African-Americans and other people throughout the world. And so the idea is what Imam Muhammad said back in the 80s when he created this organization called CRADE, which I'm sure you remember very well, committed to remove all images from the divine. And that's where the racism starts. That's where the racism starts. And so if that happened, it would mean the end of white supremacy. It would mean, you know, that a lot of the things that are going on now in the world with these wars, and all of these, I mean, with the resultant immigrants, refugees and so forth and so on, that we'll see an end to all of this. But the main problem is this, and that the images of white supremacy, which is inside of the Arab culture, I mean, I've already said it's inside of our culture, the African-American culture. So no one has really escaped it. And so until that is removed, then we're going to be getting these kinds of problems that we see. And that, and we have to, the Muslim has to awaken himself to the fact that the social problems that are out here, you know, is that we have to, this is a part of our mandate as Muslims, and that we should go after removing poverty and doing those things that we have, that we started doing in the first experience and that we continued under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. We just have to be more vigilant about it because Satan is, you know, alive and active.
I want to ask you, you and I have spoken privately about how we have had a fetish for Arabic, and you have done some things that I think is interesting, to say the least, in shocking people that make the devotional practices with you. I don't even like to call it prayer, because I think you know, the language can really confuse us. We don't watch. We'll be back into the Pentecostal church in the 1950s shouting. By this time, we'll be saying Alhamdulillah and not realizing that we're just old Christians that with the idea that you can give me you can take the world and give me God or give me Jesus, but we don't say that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have really made some very important points on even the use of Arabic in your devotional practice. Would you care to share that with us?
Well, I pray in English. And as I was saying, the reason I pray in English is that I know that Allah understands everything. He understands the intentions in my heart and whatever language that I speak. And so, but when I pray to him, I want to understand what I'm saying. And so I don't think that if I'm trying to pray to get some money for my light bill or something, that I have to, I need to go and get a dictionary to make sure that my grammar is perfect. And so Allah gave us this language, you know, and this is what we should use. As an intellectual exercise, you know, I mean, I look into Arabic and because this is the language that the Quran was revealed in. But when I pray, I mean, I pray to my God from my heart. And I've done this for a while now.
What has been the reaction of Muslim African Americans to this kind of
silent,
this approach?
More or less kind of a silent type of a reaction, I would say. No one really says anything. I've had certain young students who would say that it must be done in Arabic because of this and But if you recall, Imam Muhammad, he went after our reliance on the Hadith, and it was the Prophet, I mean, it was the Quran said that the Prophet, that I mean, Allah protected, and not these traditions from the Arabs. And I think another thing was very fitting as far as the history is that when the prophet died, peace be upon him. When the prophet died, Bilal, you know, who, you know, I mean, I think most of the listeners may have heard about Bilal. He was one of the first African, if not the first African convert to follow Prophet Muhammad. And but when the prophet died, he left. I mean, before Abu Bakr, one of the prophet's early companions, when he went to free him, I mean, the prophet had heard about Bilal and his sincerity. And so he sent Abu Bakr to free him. And so that he asked Abu Bakr, he said, are you freeing me so I can serve you or so I could serve Allah? And Abu Bakr, I'm sure he was stunned because they were torturing Bilal and doing everything else. He said, well, I'm freeing you so you can serve Allah. And so then he accepted the conditions of the release. And as soon as the prophet died, he got out of Mecca. He got out of Mecca. You may ask why. I guess we can only speculate, but I mean, when
maybe,
I was
maybe
over
the same
there,
reason why I will stay away from immigrant messages.
and when you and I were over there, we observed the position of the Africans. They were the street beggars.
So they were the kings.
Were the
when you were there, did you see the Africans as the kings and the managers and the mayors and the doctors and the potentates? Wasn't that? I mean, I wear glasses, so I don't know whether I was seeing it wrongly or not. So that's why I'm asking you. I thought they were in great positions of authority.
I saw them in very menial positions as far as laborers. And
there's a street in Mecca called Bilal Street, and that's where all the Africans live at, and it was flies and dirty and nasty. I didn't go halfway down the block because I'd seen enough of Harlem and other neighborhoods
in
where
fact,
I grew up to go to Mecca, and no African mm-hmm. people was treated like dogs. In fact, you know, a brother told me he was just in Mecca recently, and he said he saw an African man in line waiting to get medicine, and an Egyptian guy came up to him and snatched him out of line, and the poor African just stood there, and he said, since he had an American passport, he knew that they wouldn't bother him. He grabbed the man and his wife and snatched them out of the line and put the African back in line. So, and that's why I
said
a long white box.
You see, we are different people. We are different people. You know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us this, Imam Muhammad told us that we have been raised up and we have a different spirit. Allah has given us a spirit that's different from the other black people in the world. And when we see injustice like that against our people, we'll rise up. I notice here in this country, especially since 9/11, you say assalamu alaikum to somebody from over there, they'll ignore you, say some kind of code word, so, you know, something like that, you know. And so it's this fear that they have, you know, I guess maybe being deported or just, maybe they got some instructions to say, don't say it, or I don't know what the case is. But I know that in general, they do not give you, they not return the greetings. And so, you go to their mosque, you know, and they'll, you know, I mean, what they used to do, I mean, say, like, I'd be talking to somebody, maybe somebody from work or some, you know, Arab or somebody, then somebody would come up and start talking in Arabic. And so I used to just kind of, you know, just stand there and, you know, and just wait, you know. And so I started a while ago saying, speak English. Speak English. And so then now no one does that. I guess they have a description for whatever they want to call me, like I care. But
I gave the greetings to a Pakistani lady. And finally I said to her, I want just for curiosity, not that I give a damn whether she ever gave me the greetings or not, but I want to know what was her reasoning for not returning the greetings. And she said to me that she had been told not to give greetings to non-Muslims. And I told her my name was, said it in her language, my name was Muhammad and Masajjah. And she looked at me asking, but she said she had been, I said, where is that in the Quran? She said, that's in the Hadith. And I said, these people, they come here conditioning to put us at the back of a camel or the back of a Rudy shop. We have already fought our way off of the back of the bus and fought our way to the top in America. At least Mother Michelle is the first lady. I'm not going to go into the rest of it. But I think that I wanted to make a comment, too, about this before, and then ask you a comment on it. Booker D. Washington, as early as the turn of the century, had asked the Caucasians of the South not to invite any more immigrants. And he was talking about Caucasians. Every time our population go up, there's a strategy to weaken our population, our resolve. The Nation of Islam was cleaning our people up. And they knew if they would bring in other, they knew that Imam Muhammad would come in office. So all of a sudden, as soon as he came in office, they flooded America with a lot of immigrant Muslims. And Imam Muhammad was prompted to say that the immigrant Muslims is the snake in the garden. And I think that we have to understand that. I have to understand that I can make more hay with some of these southern evangelical Caucasians than I can make with these so-called Muslims from overseas. Any comment on that?
I agree. Well, they, as we said before, they didn't come here for Dawah. They came for Dawah. And so they came here to make money. And, you know, I remember when we were trying to get an Islamic effort going for, you know, grandchildren and so forth, that one of them told me, said, if we wanted Islamic school, we would have stayed in our own country. And so I thought that was a very honest answer. You know, I mean, of course, I didn't agree that this was the case, but I think it was a very honest answer. And so, you know, if they want to come here to make money, it's between them and Massa. But see, here's where the deceit comes in, is that we think that they represent the leadership of this religion. We represent the leadership, and the sooner we recognize them, the quicker we will make progress, is that Arabic is not the main criteria for deciding whether people are leading this religion. And, you know, it's we don't really understand the language. And, you know, the thing of it is, you just use enough, you know, maybe that you will, I mean, you can remember, you know, what happened with the, during the time of the prophet and so forth and so on. But you got to deal with these real problems that we have, like we were saying before, the mothers that are still having babies out there, the kids who are dropping out of school, the prison population, the drug population, alcohol and other things that I characterize as emancipation too. These are the things that are destroying our neighborhood. And if we don't address these issues, as I said earlier, why should these black colleges remain open? I finished that 50 years ago this year, and so I go back to KC, and I look at the bench where me and, you know, my girlfriend used to sit, you know, in the evening and, you know, and do girlfriend, boyfriend things, you know, in the open. the innocent things that we used to do. But that's not good enough. I mean, Master's saying, no. I mean, I don't care if you like where the bench is located and so forth, and it brings back fun memories. We got to have some kind of stock in trade that the rulers, the money rulers in the society will say, these places should remain open because they're making a contribution to solving some of the ills in the society. And that's where we've fallen short as a people. I mean, we give to the church. That's the only place we really give to. We don't give back to the black colleges. You know, and so the money that we get, we have to depend on the white community. That's just a fact. And so, you know, unless we, like I said, I repeat, unless we develop a stock in trade, you know, is get rid of some of those problems that we have and be working on them to get rid of them, I should say, at least, then there's no justifiable reason, I mean, for them to stay open, because many of the white schools are cheaper than the black schools. Their facilities, in many cases, in most cases, are better. You know how that goes. And so, you know, so why should we stay open? And like I said, memorabilia is not good enough. And so that's, I don't know if I've answered your question or not. I guess
no, I think you did. I think that two questions jump out at me. We support churches, and we're now poorly supporting Miss Hodges. But I think that what I intend for the rest of the time that I'm on earth is to launch a massive self-help movement among our people. I think we should stop saying we're poor. I'm convinced that with $2.1 trillion, and this weekend, there are over 10,000 African-Americans well-to-do people in Washington. They're partying. They're drinking the finest liquors. They're living in the best hotels. If each of those 10,000 persons were to commit themselves to giving $10,000. I mean, these are people who can afford $10,000. That could be $100 million to support the historical black colleges and universities. The Catholics support their institutions. The Jews support their institutions. The Mormons support their institutions. We're the only group in America that is content to be a race of beggars. And I'm not ashamed to call us out on it. Also, Minister Louis Farrakhan, that I'm sure you know, is engaged in another debacle, and he's going to call 1 million people. Only this time they're going to call poor whites, homosexuals, all the misfits, along with African American, to say justice or else. And it just seemed to me that he could take that time. If you could get 1 million African Americans to give $20 per week and to give 1 day a week to help our people, and 5 years we would be the most competitive people on the face of the planet Earth. What do you think of that proposal?
Yeah, I think it's good, but I also think this is that I think that there are more people than African Americans who would support the causes that we have expounded for decades. You know what I mean? And I think that they've always been there supporting them. And that we should, we should have a base, you know, that depends only on African Americans. And we should have a base where Americans can say, this is a cause that's going to help this whole country.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I agree.
Because if we're... Because we have plenty... We have many, many people here who do have the means. I mean, you know, like the billionaires and, you know, maybe not so billionaires, that if there were causes like the ones that we're talking about, eliminating some of the problems, I mean, this elimination, if we cut back on the prison population alone, you know, we help the whole society.
Except that the Correctional Corporation of America and all the other prisons, companies would not be very happy with that proposal.
But, you know, the thing of it is that there would be a split. There would be some who would be happy and some who would not be happy. And
right.
We want to approach those who would be. And we'll say, I mean, of course, our community would be happy. And, you know, and then the other things that we talked about, the ills that are going on, the dropouts, you know, the problems that we're having in our community, if we approach those with sound solutions, I believe that there are many, many people who will line up behind us, and that the black colleges, if they accept the terms of the original mandate, going back to, you know, emancipation and what they were supposed to have done, then we would be surviving, and there would be many people who would be stepping up to the plate to support the institutions. But the continuous of the institution must have the type of support that you're describing.
I agree with you. I think that they have to have a mission. I think we have to. I don't think our people are fired up and motivated. I was listening to a lecture that Imam Muhammad gave in 1992, and it's been my mandate since then. I believe it was 1992 that you facilitated my meeting Imam Muhammad of reuniting with him there in Huntsville, Alabama. It was a watershed year because in May of 1992, he gave an address in Atlanta, Georgia, wherein he stated that the next phase of his mission was not so much to Islamize us, but to motivate African Americans. I just don't think African Americans have been motivated properly to be to have a collective goal. With all due respect, I'm not interested in any other people. I mean, you just have a limited mission. You know, I believe Allah put me on the earth to wake my people up. Now, others can go out and do other things, but that's not what I'm motivated to do. I believe that this sleeping giant that has $2.1 trillion can be awakened. And just like we bought airplanes for the honor of Elijah Muhammad, I believe that millions of more will go into a massive self-help movement, just like you and I when you were Robert C. 29 or Alpha 28X. We took to the streets, fired up, jacked up, and speared up. And we went out to our people. And I remember one time you and I had gone to a lady's house, and we were selling papers, and her and her husband was in a dispute. You better not remember that. And she said, I'm going to wait till Brother Alfred them come to my house and ask them to solve that problem. Now, we were 24, 25 years old. The lady and the man must have been 40. But they had that kind of trust in us. And same thing, we remember the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Young people must be fired up to solve our people's problems. And let's act as though no other people on the earth exist. Now, I don't mind allies coming and helping us. But, you know, I don't want you feeding my babies. That's my obligation. I think we got to take this self-responsibility. But I do think that you are 100% right, that all of the African-American students, let's start the African-American colleges, must take on a mission of saving our people. Our middle class, while they drink that good scotch and smoke that good weed, they should think, look, let me put some of my money aside to help Ray Ray and Keisha. Let me tutor somebody who's illiterate. Let me work with somebody who can't do math. And let's pull our race up. Because I believe if we don't do it, I believe we're going to be punished. And I'm speaking as a spiritual man now. First of all, this program Religion Means a Lie, it's not a Muslim program.
That's right.
I am a Muslim, you're a Muslim. But we're here to wake our people up. This is what the purpose of this program is. Not to invite people to be Muslim.
Right.
If they become Muslim, that's fine. Mm-hmm. If they become good Christians, that's fine. But if all they can do is become Christians or Muslims and don't do a damn thing, I don't care what they state. To me, it's just still in
bad shape. I agree with you 100%.
I don't want to hear this kind of talk.
And we're going back 45 years of agreements because we were, like you said, we were young men, 20, 25, 26, and we accepted the mandates of the mission that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad put there to pull our people up out of the muck and mire. And we were determined, we were dedicated to that. And so that's still valid. Maybe it's even more valid today than it was then. I remember that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, remember when he had Savior's Day? Oh, when was it? It was one year, it was a Caucasian on the stage, right? And he was teaching as though everything was normal. And so maybe about 15 minutes into his lecture or something, he said, I know all of you are wondering why this Caucasian is up here. And then he said, so you would be very unwise if you are not fair to those who are fair to you.
Yes.
Hello? Oh, okay.
I'm here. I remember that.
And, you know, so I'm just saying that, I mean, they say Allah will surround you with angels if you step out here and try to do the right thing. And whatever color, whatever nationality, whatever gender, or whatever, Allah will give us the kind of support that we need if we try to do the right thing in the terms that we're describing. And so you know, it's forces out here that are waiting for us to move. You know what I mean? And
yes,
Allah will give us what we need.
I believe that 100%. I believe that we have even seen the beginning of the kind of support we would get if we began a massive self-help movement and we showed more interest. I think we've gone to sleep. I think that what has happened to our people, we're wandering in the wilderness. I want to get back to this African-American college. Historical black colleges and universities are very
passionate
concept in my mind. I want to, you talked about the prison industrial. Oh, I'm in the wrong place here. I'm hearing a rebound. The prison industrial complex growing stronger than the African American college students. What's up with that?
Right.
As a young would say.
Well, you see, here's what is happening. I notice it at A&M. I notice it at most of the schools. The infrastructure of these schools basically have been taken over by the immigrant community. And I don't even think it's appropriate to describe it as taken over. It's been given over to them by the leadership here. And so it's just a matter of time before they declare these historically black colleges as simply colleges so they can have a language that's more pleasing to master. You know what I mean? And so that they, I mean, the infrastructure, the committees, and, you know, the subcommittees and so forth, and even so much so that they are going to recruit, they're recruiting students from their own countries to come here. And in this artificial language, minorities and diversity, and you got the black bourgeoisie say, yeah, you know. In fact, they look upon the people from overseas as just being light-skinned African Americans with good hair. You know what good hair is. You know what
yes,
I mean?
Yes, sir. Unfortunately, I do. That's why we need the revival of the
fair skin, as opposed to unfair skin, and good hair. You know, and so, but like I said, they failed to conceive the cultural divide here back in the 60s. We thought it was simply a race problem, but it's a class problem. It is a class problem that exists. And so, you know, what we're getting is the top 5% of the immigrants from overseas. We look at on late night TV and we see these poor Africans and poor Indians that they want us to send $9.95 to feed 10 for 1 month. And so, no, that's not who come over here. These ones that come over here stepped on the heads of those in their own country. They come over here, and they don't give a cuss about them. And so what makes us think that once they get here that they're going to say, oh, let me go and help those poor African Americans? You see, and so they came here for one purpose, and that was to make money. And it's sad in the case of the of our African brothers and sisters, because you know the ones they left behind are even poorer than many of the people that come from other parts of the world, and they tell you, well, we are African Americans, and so that's why I was telling you I put after my name DAS, descended from American slavery. I said you may be African, so forth and so on. But you're not a DAS. You can't be a DAS. We'll call you maybe a DEC, descended from European colonialism. But see, the DAS title has a price tag because, and this is 400 years of work that went uncompensated. And we should always leave that on the table. No matter what our young people say, the bourgeoisie, they just lost many of the kids, you know, in the leadership now. I'm talking in their 40s. They're just lost. They don't.
We collectively failed them. We didn't give them the ancestral spirit. And some of us have really allowed ourselves to get a misunderstanding of Imam Muhammad. You know, Imam Muhammad was equally concerned about establishing our people as he was as about establishing the religion. A people that are not a people can't even absorb a religion. Some of us think
magic. Proof of that is that he stayed. He started a community within the African American community. You know what I mean?
The second proof is that he lived in an African American community. He said this. This is a quote. He said, "Why should I live anywhere else?" A lot of people didn't know Imam Muhammad was not for interracial marriages. In fact, if you go on YouTube, you can hear him answer. So we didn't get a picture of Imam Muhammad. Work is uplifting our people. I see everybody's looking for everybody else. I'm first and foremost unapologetic, without hesitation, without reservation. I'm an avowed uplift man for African American people. And as you know, you certainly know, and I largely hold you responsible in a good way for reuniting me in the circle of leadership. I never forget you called me one day. Down that day, you said, Brother Alfred, I was an active imam at the time, but you said to me, Imam Muhammad is going to be at my college at Alabama A&M. And somehow or another, I took a Greyhound bus. I think it took me 22 hours to get to Huntsville. And next thing I found myself, you and Imam Muhammad smiling, and next thing I know, I was in the back room with Imam Muhammad and Clyde Rothman, and I've been back in the leadership circle ever since. And I was always passionate about our people. I would never give that up. I didn't come into Ellis Farm to throw my people under the bus. No, I came with a better tool. I just want to ask you this question, because you were involved in the civil rights movement, what was it about the Nation of Islam? Now, I know you're going to get nervous when I tell the audience this, but at 19 you had graduated from college, you'd gone to Princeton University with a master's in chemistry, and you had left Princeton University in the doctoral program to teach in Muhammad's University of Islam for probably $100,000 a year. I'd be in facetious, probably $100 a week. I remember you had to have another job just to support yourself, probably another job just to pay for the papers. Those were good days. I remember. I think you were living on 49th Street. Those were good days. We soldiered. I was happier then than I ever was because we were uplifting our people. What made you come into the Nation of Islam? But just before you answer that, it would be unfair of me to our audience to tell you you couldn't join the conversation. Dial 805-727-7013, press 1. Now, this is not here for anybody to come and lecture. This is a talk show. It's a discussion. So if you got any questions or brief comments, you have questions for Dr. Razi Hassan, formerly known as Brother Robert C. 29X, in New York City, number 7, also was in Trenton. And we're not into Auld Lang Syne. We're into talking about how we can uplift our people, although we're going to look back for the purpose of going forward. Dr. Razi, Brother Robert, you can please, the descendant of slavery, just as I was. I have a certificate of slave ownership. I was a slave on the Nowlin Plantation, on the Booker Plantation. I don't claim that, say, I was a Booker. I'm not a Booker because I never was owned by Booker. They couldn't own me. But I lived on this plantation by captive. And I told a group of Muslims this, too. I said, you can't tell me how to teach Islam. You had nothing to do with my making. You were not involved.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. In my making. In fact, I was a captive. That's what I stated at the United Nations. I was a Muslim captive, and nobody came to aid me but God himself. So, Dear beloved people, you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. Doctor, would you please continue to answer? I'm sorry.
Oh, I was here asking why did I leave Princeton and go to New York? First of all, where I came in contact with the nation is that when I was at Princeton, Muhammad Ali was speaking, and, he had just been, this was around 1967, right? And they had just taken his championship. And so he was talking about black people in Africa doing things and everything. I knew Muslims who were going to school there, but, I didn't know anything about all the stuff that he was talking about, the greatness of black people and so forth. And so that was inspiring. He was talking about everything that black people were doing. And so in 1969, that's when I joined. I told people there were three places that I met Muhammad Ali. I met him one time, at Princeton. Next time, I think it was he was speaking at a nightclub or something. And the third time that I met him is when we were at the Muhammad University of Islam in Harlem. And so I left Princeton, and I moved to New York, and and I started working for the Nation of Islam. First, I started grad school in New York, but then I dropped out and started working for the Nation of Islam, University of Islam, Muhammad University of Islam. And and then after the Honorable Elijah Muhammad died, then just looking for gravity. And so then I decided to go back to grad school. This was in 1975. But we underestimate sometimes, the intellectual nature of what was being taught to us in the nation. Because we were boys out there. A good book came up. We would, go and read it. We were looking just to try to find things to justify our legitimacy. And, I didn't learn that in any of the colleges that I had gone to before I, started working for the nation. And so I'm thankful. I am very, very thankful for that introduction. I'm thankful for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad for opening my eyes, and thankful for the Imam Warafdi Muhammad for blessing me to see more clearly. And, we just had two strong teachers. And, to bring us from boyhood into manhood. And as I look around now, still this kind of blindness exists. It's that we don't know who we are. This is why we identify so much. You call them the devils incarnate, the immigrant communities. I call them the Trojan horses, because we thought we were getting one thing, but we were getting something different. And so... So it's just a thing that's happening to the black colleges, and the rate that they're going. You see, somebody, but I do notice this, is that when I make speeches in certain places, the black bourgeoisie is listening. I know one of my favorite statements is that slavery was not a diversity program. It was not minorities that came over here to build America. It was our ancestors, and as such, then, the schools that were set up as a part of the reparations, and that we want to enhance that. And that, with all due respect to our brothers and sisters of all races and nationalities from overseas, the fact of the matter is that we should be encouraging them to go back and help the poor in their own countries, not helping to make it more comfortable for them here in America by giving away opportunities that should be going to our own people anyway.
What can we do about the prison industrial complex and the cultural apparatus, which is the trap? Young people now here, probably throughout the United States, are calling, young ladies are saying, oh, wow, he's trapping. And they're looking up to young men that are committing drug acts, criminal acts, to get money. Being a gangster is glorified. What can we do?
Well, they were,
decent citizens.
Well, they were doing the same thing when we were boys out there on the streets. They were looking up to
yes.
them. That hasn't changed. We just
Has
have
it
to
gotten worse?
Be firm. We have to be firm on our commitment, you know, to what we're about. It's just, I mean, Satan, you know, is going to be out there. He's alive and active, and, you know, and we just have to make sure that he loses. And, you know, you mentioned the black colleges. This is one conduit. We should have programs set up, you know, to educate these brothers, you know, and sisters from there. But, you know, I see it's one of the main things that we need for these sisters to have these babies at a young age. I was telling some people, I said, and on this campus, it should be somewhere for teaching that little baby, I mean, put him in the nursery while his mama goes to school, either to complete her high school education or going to college, and that baby is over there studying nuclear physics. And we can introduce these things to them at a very, very young age, so that by the time that mama finishes her education, then baby, you know, is well on track for knowing the type of thing that he needs to do in order to get ahead in life. And that should be the purpose of this campus. These campuses.
Well, you would be happy to know that one of our colleagues, Brother George Caldoun, he's recently retired, but he was working at the Harlem. He's one of the founders of the Harlem Children's Zone, and they're doing just that. I think the historical black colleges.
He's the founder of what now?
The Harlem Children's Zone. And it's an organization that runs schools, but they have something called the baby college from 0 to 3, where the mother is brought in and she's educated on how to be a parent, and also the child is educated. And I think that the schools of education at our historical black colleges should engage that. And you're right, we should have nurseries. There should be apartment complexes on these campuses so these women who have children can raise their children, and people in early childhood education get practice. We need a new mission for the historical African-American colleges. We know for a fact.
This is the original mission. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. Would you restate the mission of the historical black colleges and universities?
No, I didn't. You said a state mission of the
black
colleges?
I think a lot of people have lost that mission. But would you please reiterate or give to us for the first time for some of us, what was the original intent of the historical black colleges?
Through education, we could develop the type of institutions that were going to bring us up into freedom, out of slavery. And that, but we got sidetracked. And if you look in the museums in every town, most of the original students were, you know, either light-skinned, mulatto, light, or just plain light-skinned. And, they were trying to mimic the model, not just in terms of the educational material, but even the physical looks of the slave master. And so we got sidetracked. And then when this fraternity thing started, you know, we created an elitist class within blacks, an even more elitist class. It was the light-skinned blacks that were at the top of the totem pole, and then the light-skinned blacks that were in fraternities and sororities who were at the tip of the top. And so we just got completely sidetracked from what the mission was. And unless we get back to that, you know, we're going to lose these schools. We're going to lose these schools because the black bourgeoisie, basically, you know, their thing is that, you know, all people from all over the world, these are minorities. We want to have this one in here and that one in there. We're going to get the most qualified. I'm telling you, the language that I have to listen to all the time. And so they know where I'm coming from, and they know that I'm fighting this thing here. And unless we, and I just tell you the truth, brother, ma'am, if we don't decide that we're going to take on these problems that we have as a people, then we shouldn't. The black colleges shouldn't exist. It shouldn't be a place, you know, that you can just go and have parties and look at people who are your same race and that's it. No, we got to be mission-oriented like we were in our inception. We got to be mission-oriented to the extent that we are going to free our people from the bondages of the first slavery, and the second one, because many of the vestiges of slavery are still with us, to quote Imam Warifi Muhammad.
Well, you know what? This is the name of this program. This program is Religion Means Alive, and it's dedicated to the recovery from slavery for Africans in the Americas, from Rio de Janeiro to Halifax, Nova Scotia, with a focus on the African Americans in these United States, because the most damaged people on the face of the planet Earth is those who are descendants of what Kenneth F. Stamps called the peculiar institution, the very strangest institution ever exists on Earth. And as one That's of the right. people said, we think we have wiped out the life of these people.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ayahs in Quran that I remember that you gave me, and I memorized it in Arabic, is my favorite. It's Makru or Makru Allah, Allahu Karen Makran. And they plot and God plot. And God is the best of plotters. And that term Makru really means a plot. They have plotted to make us subhuman.
Mm-hmm.
And really with people like yourself, people that followed Imam Deputy Muhammad, Ambulat Muhammad, we're breaking that plot. And I'm still in the business breaking that plot. And I hope all you listeners in that business of smashing that plot, that we're going to outplot them. We're going to educate our people. We're going to develop independent economics for our people. We're going to develop cultural institutions, governmental institutions. If this country collapses, I pray it doesn't. But the way when I look at the debates, I wonder, we had better be prepared as a people in case this country collapses. We still have to survive as a people. And I say this is politics, right? Politics, Muslim politics, I'm going to say it. I'm unapologetic. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Without hesitation.
I agree with you 100% that, and if we also agree with you that if we do this, Allah will send us the kind of assistance that we need to be successful.
Yes, sir. And just like water was under Hadj's feet, don't forget that $2.1 trillion we have. We're not a broke people. Mm-hmm. We may be broken, but we're not broke. And I have to say this. We're going to sign off. If there's any more, we're going to take this up week after next. Next week, we're going to come back again at the 8 o'clock hour and continue the discourse, because I want to have every Saturday historical black colleges and universities. I've asked
thank you, Brother Imam, for that you're doing.
And all the good that
you're
doing, and we hope to be at Alabama A&M per your invitation as soon as possible. Alabama A&M is very dear to our heart, because it was where we resurrected and the leadership circle of Imam Deputy Muhammad. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive.